Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Orhan Pamuk. Orhan Pamuk first discovered storytelling through art, devoting himself to the pursuit of a painter's life throughout his childhood and early 20s, including 3 years spent studying architecture at Istanbul Technical University. At age 23, Pamuk experienced a change of heart, decided to become a novelist, and succeeded in publishing his first novel, Sevded Bey and His Sons, only 7 years later. Quote, "I'm happier when I paint and draw, but I definitely feel more intelligent when I write," he said. In 1985, his third novel, The White Castle, earned him international notoriety. During this year, Pamuk traveled to New York to act as a visiting scholar at Columbia University, where he stayed for 3 years. Apart from his time at Columbia, which he visits once a year as a guest lecturer, Pamuk has resided in the same district of Istanbul for his entire life and even lives in the same building where he was raised. Not surprisingly, then, his novels focus primarily on the social and political structures of Turkey, as well as the conflict between Eastern and Western values. Quote, "It's impossible to avoid politics and be a famous Turkish writer, even if you only write about roses and butterflies," he stated in an interview for The Guardian. To date, he has published 18 books that have sold over 11 million copies and have been translated into more than 60 languages, making him Turkey's best-selling author. In 2006, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, distinguishing him as Turkey's first Nobel laureate. Regardless of this national and international fame, however, Pamuk's primary concern has remained the same, embodied in the handwritten note that resides above his writing desk, which reads, quote, "I am only writing for that person who thinks I am only writing for that person." Now, from the 2007-2008 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Orhan Pamuk speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Very pleased to be here, very honored to be here. I will read from my latest book published here, Other Colors, which is a collection of articles, personal notes, resentments, selections from interviews. It's all little picked up pieces from my diaries, journals, my answers to various questions, magazines, political writings, book reviews, so forth and so on. The title refers to the question I've been asked by the journalists who never read my books but pay attention to the titles. They say, oh, since they don't read the book, they have to make a comment. They say, oh, Mr. Pamuk, you've written The White Castle, The Black Book, My Name is Red. Some colors in your titles. What do you mean by that? Being a professional writer, of course, implies that you don't embarrass the journalists by saying that, look, only the journalists who never read my books ask these questions. You have to be professional. So I answer that, you know, that there is a lot of color symbolism in Islam, is in Islamic literature, but I don't use it. I'm a visual writer. I wanted to be a painter between the age of 7 and 22, and perhaps that's why I pay attention to details of surface, colors, things that surround my characters. I also try to describe them. But on the other hand, the title of the book refers also to the fact that these slices of life I put together in this book are things that I have experienced intensely, that I have felt that sooner or later that they may end up in one of my books. But unfortunately, so many years had passed that I could not find a place, an integral space in one of my stories, in my books. So here I published them in a book, or in a sort of a compilation of articles. The original version of this book I published, I think, in 2001 in Turkey. Then in between the 6 years, I wrote so many new articles. Some of the articles that I originally published in a book form in Turkey, perhaps were too Turkish, too political. I deleted them and carved up all the new things that I've written to form perhaps a continuous narrative, autobiographical narrative. In 2003 in Turkey, I published a book called Istanbul, and a book half autobiography, half a sort of a chronicle of the city or how the image of Istanbul was developed by first some Western travelers who came to the town in mid-19th century, then by in 20th century local Turkish writers who developed a sense of the city, an idea of, quote, beautiful Istanbul. In that book, I argued that the landscapes or, quote, the beauty of a city is also involved to main sentiments that city carry around. It was the German philosopher and writer Walter Benjamin made this comment about books written about cities. There are two kinds of city books, he said. Those that are written by people who come to city from outside, that kind of city books tend to be a bit exotic, he said, because visitors who come to cities from outside tend to see things that they do not have because they find these things interesting and dramatize and exoticize and sugarize these peculiarities of the cities. Books that are written from insiders like me, so to speak, tend to be books of memory, he also pointed out, which is correct. And as soon as I began writing about Istanbul, an idea that I decided that I will one day write a book about Istanbul, I thought this was true, that my book on Istanbul was, as I wrote it, was getting to be also a book of memories. So I decided to divide it into two and wrote a sort of a eclectic or perhaps combination of personal memory and a sort of a discourse on the meaning of the urban scapes of Istanbul. That was Istanbul. I wrote so many articles, so many essays, so many little things in Istanbul. I spent all my life there. For the last 53 years, I'm living there, not necessarily leaving it, but in the last 2 years, I'm traveling around the world a lot, teaching in New York at Columbia University every fall season. In this book, I also put together the articles that I wrote about Istanbul that I could not place in any other book of mine. Here is some sort of an autobiographical, also essayistic discourse about Istanbul's barbershops. I like barbers. I like to pay attention to how writers I like, pay attention to barbers. Very few do, but some do. Barbers for me are grounds where community meet. Let me read about what I wrote about barbers. That was a long article. I'll read some parts, which is in this book, Other Colors. When I was a boy, waiting my turn at the barber shop, flipping through the pages of Vulture, which is in Turkish Akbaba, a very popular humor magazine, stopping now and again to study locally drawn caricatures of citizens aghast at the prices of things, enjoying jokes about bosses and their secretaries, stories by the popular humorists and cartoons lifted from Western magazines, my ears were always alert to the conversations around me. Don't forget, I'm a boy now. Of course, the topic discussed at the greatest length was football and the football pools. Some, like Toto, the head barber, would, as he moved among the three customers in the three chairs, offer up his thoughts on boxing or the horses, which he played from time to time. His barbershop, which bore the fanciful name of Venus, was at the end of a passageway across the street from our house in Nişantaşı. Toto was a tired and sulky man with white hair, and the other of the two older owners was irritable and bald, while the third owner was in his 40s and sported a thin Douglas Fairbanks mustache. That was a very popular type of description of mustache, which stayed with the Turkish language as Douglas Bıyık. No one remembers Douglas Fairbanks, but he is now remembered only by his mustache. I remember he was less interested, I mean the barber, not the Fairbanks, in chatting with his customers about high prices, new shops in the neighborhood, singers and stars of the day, or the domestic politics than he was in discussing international affairs and the state of the world. What impressed me was how, when a customer arrived who was particularly eminent, learned, expert, powerful, or upper class, this barber and the others would start with humble questions beginning with, "We, of course, have no idea." And once they had drawn him out, they would quickly move to the conversation, square into the man's field of knowledge and power. If they got an answer like, "It costs this many liras," or "Those cargo ships are bigger than a football field," or if they were told that a famous politician had a shocking weakness or had committed an act of cowardice, they would either mutter something like, or chirp, 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 like so many little birds, or the razor that had been gliding so smoothly and close would stop for a moment while barber and customer eyed each other in the mirror, and an interesting silence would ensue. If, after trying to open a conversation with questions like, "So what's happening?" or "How are things?" or "May I offer you tea?" the customer remained grim and silent, they would jabber among themselves. In these conversations, one played the man always down on his luck, the second the buff of every joke, and the third ever the cunning one. The way they used to needle one another in these conversations, as in Mehmet outwitted Toto once again this week, remind me of the sparring I'd hear on the radio between Karagöz, the hero of traditional shadow theater, and his sharp-tongued friend, Hajivat. Once, after a customer had had his shave taken off his apron, allowed the boy to comb his hair, given out his tips, and left the shop, the Fairbanks mustache sporting owner, who had shown him such courtesy and deference only moments earlier, began to curse this man's mother and his wife. Now, now I'm a boy here. I was very young. This was how I discovered that the adult world was populated by duplicitous types whose anger was deeper than anything I had known in my child's world. At the barber shop of my childhood, they used scissors, huge clippers they would angrily toss away when they didn't cut well, like doing this, combs, cotton balls to keep hair out of the ears, cologne, powder, and for the grown-ups, cutthroat razors, shaving cream, shaving combs, and white aprons. Today, apart from a handful of electric appliances like the hairdryer, the tools have not changed much, and this must remind us that though Istanbul writers have never recorded their traditions, these barbers, who have been using the same tools for centuries, gossiping as they work, must have been speaking in the same way for just as long. We can see in miniatures of the age that the cutthroat razor was in use in the 17th century. When passing before Sultan Ahmed, now we are in 17th century, representatives of the Barbers Guild, wishing to prove their fine talents, had a barber suspended upside down from the roof of the exhibition carriage as he gave his customers a perfect shave. In those days, the head of the man to be shaved would rest against the barber's knee. This custom paved the way for a classic love story in which a man contrived to have all his hair, his beard, his mustache, and his every whisker and bristle removed just to be near a beautiful barber's apprentice. We see the same motif in the folk tale about Kerem and Asli, in which, very classical folk tale, in which the lover has feet pulled just to be close to a beautiful dentist, a reminder that barbers and dentists were both seen as possessing expert knowledge and somehow overlapping expertise. Barbers also perform circumcisions and other small surgical procedures. This was history. Some in their coffee houses and others in separate establishments. This gave them a central importance in Istanbul society. But when I was a child, what frightened me about barbers was that they could pull words from our mouths as skillfully as dentists extract teeth and disseminate them as fast as any newspaper. Here are my anxieties. This is why when I was sitting in the Venus barbershop reading Vulture and heard a voice say, "Come along now, young master," I would be as tense as if I had been invited to take my place in a dentist chair. It was not just because the trimmer sometimes pulled the hairs on my neck or the point of the scissors dug into me. My visits to barbershop always seemed to involve pain. I was afraid because I thought I might let some family secret slip. I had an uncle who'd gone to America and never returned. After they had passed a white cloth over my head and fastened it as one might about a man headed for gallows, the first question they would ask was, "When is your uncle coming back from America?" I didn't know. "How many years has he been gone?" "He's been gone so long," another would answer. "He'll never come back." "No, never." "Did he ever do his military service?" There would follow a silence. I would stare in front of me as ashamed as if I had been the one who'd fled the country before his military service. And I'd remember my grandmother crying as she read my uncle's ever more infrequent letters in ever more broken Turkish. But my real fear was that the barbers might extract from me yet other secrets that my family had succeeded in hiding and that I had no wish to remember. Was it because I'd foreseen these perils and because I felt from the moment I walked in that I would soon be sweating as profusely as I might today, sitting opposite a journalist with an interest in my private life, that on my very first visit to the barber, I burst into tears? For my next few haircuts, and on days when I was ill, Toto, the owner with the white hair and the joyless face, would pack the pools of his trade into a bag and come to the house to cut my hair. He'd spread a newspaper on the table, place a stool on top, and sit me on it so I was at the same height as his scissors. This gloomy man, who held himself apart from his loquacious friends and remained silent here too, and because I enjoyed this interlude as little as he did, it wasn't long before I returned to the barber shop for my haircuts. That was when I understood that a barber who shaves you in silence without drawing a word from your mouth or sharing any neighborhood or political gossip and cursing no one is not a barber at all. This is typical of the essays, fragmentary writings that I put together in this book. Especially in my early years, when I was trying to establish myself as a writer in Turkey, I would be open to any questions that magazines, newspapers, that would ask that would perhaps improve my image in the Turkish media. A thing that all authors do, with a little bit of embarrassment, but I felt that I should do it. One day, they asked me about my wristwatches. Here is my answer. I began to wear my, this was probably in mid-1990s. I began to wear my first wristwatch in 1965 when I was 12. Then, in 1970, I got rid of it. By then, it was too old. It wasn't a fancy brand, just an ordinary one. In 1970, I bought an Omega, and I used it until 1983. This, my third watch, is an Omega 2. It's not very old. My wife bought it for me at the end of 1983, a few months after The Silent House was published. Now, that I'm like this, so many authors I have met are like me, in the sense that just like school teacher people, grown-ups, when they refer to some past time, they refer to, "Oh, I was in the second grade then." "Oh, I was finishing high school then." I also say, "Oh, I was finishing, my name is Red then." For me, past is always associated with the book that I was troubled with. A watch feels like part of my body. When I write, it sits on my desk, and I look at it a little nervously. Before I sit down to write, when I take it off and set it on the table, I feel like someone who has taken off his shirt to play football, like a boxer preparing for a match, especially if I put my watch on the table after coming in from the street. For me, it is a gesture that denotes a preparation for battle. In the same way, when I'm leaving the house, if after working for five or 6 hours things have gone well, if I've been able to write successfully, I very much like putting my watch back on, so much so that doing it gives me the pleasure of achievement, of work completed. I rise from my table quickly. As soon as I've put my key and my money into my pocket, I walk straight out. I don't wait to put on my watch. My watch will be in my hand. It's when I reach the pavement, when I'm walking down the street, that I put on my watch. For me, this is a great pleasure. All these things are merged in my mind with having struggled and prevailed. I've never caught myself thinking how quickly time passed. I'll look at the face of the watch and it will seem as if the hour and the minute hands have arrived at the place where they were meant to be, but I don't think of this as an idea or even as a particle of time. This is why I shall never buy a digital watch. Digital watches represent those particles of time as numbers, whereas the face of my watch is a mysterious icon. I love to look at it. The face of time, in some way, it conjures up that metaphysical conceit or something close to it. My most beautiful watch is the oldest one, the one I'm most used to. I feel attached to my watch as an object. This metaphysical affinity, this sense of enchantment goes back to my first days of watch wearing in middle school, but later it became linked in my mind with school bells, and so it has remained for many years. I take an optimistic view of time. As a rule, if a call takes me 12 minutes, I think I can do it in 9. Or if a call takes 23 minutes, I can do it in 17. But even if I can't, I don't get discouraged. When I go to bed, I take off my watch and put it somewhere near me. The first thing I do when I wake up is to reach out and look at it. My watch is like a very close friend. I don't even like changing the straps when they get worn. They carry the scent of my skin. In the old days, I would begin to write around 12 o'clock and work until evening, but my real writing time was between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m. I would go to bed at 4. Until my daughter was born, I would work nights right through to morning. During these hours, when everyone was asleep, my watch face would watch me. Then this routine changed. From 1996, I got into the habit of waking at 5 and working until 7. Then I would wake up my wife and my daughter, and after eating breakfast with them, I'd take my daughter to school. Between 1997 and 1999, I wrote weekly columns for a Turkish magazine. And this was a humor magazine with political overtones. But I was not writing political articles for them. I was writing just whatever came to my mind. And in fact, I thought, backing them with my presence, with my drawings, with my writings. Every week I would write something thinking that this is enough. I don't want to continue with this magazine anymore. So that magazine was called Öküz, which means ox in English. And that's the end of it. But then 7 days would pass, and Tuesday at 3 o'clock, they would call me. And I would say, hello. And they would say, oh, is your article ready, sir? Oh, I'm not writing anymore, I would say. And they would say, no, that the whole page is empty. You have to fill it. This is your responsibility. But I said, how much time do I have? And they said, we'll send someone in 3 hours. Are you ready? I said, I don't have any idea. I don't know what to do. And then they would pressure me. Then I would get, I don't know what to do. Then I would get confused. But a sort of a responsibility, a sort of commitment kept me. And I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. Interesting thing about this is that as I wrote in this book so many times that I am a hard worker, that I had been writing for the last 34 years, averaging 175 pages a year, so very little. So implying that I am very disciplined, pay attention to composition of every sentence, very meticulous, in fact, very fussy writer. But as I published these articles, I saw that no one paid much attention to my overworked sentences, while everyone loved and enjoyed my sentences, pieces that I wrote in 2 hours, and I was a bit shocked by that. One of the things, when they said, you have 2 hours, please send us the article, of course not, then you have to rely on not prepared articles, ideas that you slowly develop, but then role experience, so to speak. And I was at those days very close to my daughter, and I'm still am, and taking her to school, developing a friendship with her. She was around 6, and here is an essay that I wrote about her. My daughter's name is Rüya, which means dream in Turkish, not an uncommon Turkish name. Every morning, we go to school together, Rüya and us. One eye on the watch, one eye on the bag, the door, the road. In the car, we always do the same things. A, wave at the dogs in the little park. B, knock back and forth as the car accelerates around a corner. C, say, to the right and down the hill, Mr. Driver, casting a sidelong glance at each other and laughing. D, laughing when we say, to the right and down the hill, Mr. Driver, because he knows exactly where we're going, as we always take taxis from the same taxi stand. E, get out of the taxi and walk hand in hand. 2, after I have hung her bag on her shoulder, kissed her and let her into school, I watch her from behind. I have memorized the way Rüya walks, and I love watching her walk into school. I know she knows I'm watching her. It is as if her knowing I'm watching makes us both feel secure. First, there's a world she enters and explores every day, and then there is the world we two share. When I watch her and she turns around to watch me, we keep our world going. But then she breaks into a run and enters a new life where my eyes cannot go. 3, let me brag it a little. My daughter is intelligent and knows what she likes. She insists without a moment's hesitation that I tell the best stories, and on weekend mornings she lies down next to me and demands her due. Because she knows who she is, she knows what she wants. Quote, it should be a witch again, she should escape from prison, but she shouldn't go blind and she shouldn't grow old, and in the end, she shouldn't catch the little child. A very demanding editor. She doesn't want me skipping the parts she likes. She tells me which parts she doesn't like while I'm still telling the story. This is why telling her a story means both writing it and reading it as the child who wrote it. 4, as with all intimate relationship, ours is a power struggle. Who will decide, A, which channel to watch on television? B, what time is bedtime? C, what game will be played or not played? And how this decision and many other similar decisions, discussions, disputes, tricks, sweet deceptions, bouts of tears, rebukes, sulks, reconciliations and acts of contrition will be resolved after long political negotiations. All this effort makes us tired and happy, but in the end, it accumulates and becomes the history of the relationship, the friendship. You come to an understanding because you're not going to give up on each other. You think about each other, and when you're parted, you remember each other's smell. When she's gone, I miss the smell of her hair terribly. When I'm gone, she smells my pajamas. I put this kind of articles, some of them perhaps may be compared to what James Joyce called epiphanies, sudden bursts of creative energy, little writing down things that I have experienced, which I felt intense, which I think that I should end up in one part of some book. I compiled these things that I published in various magazines, that I wrote in my journals, some book reviews, some very serious scholarly articles, articles about Istanbul earthquake, which I felt I was very much involved in, then also anxiety about the next earthquake, about the death of my father, about spring afternoons, about being happy, about going to school, about religion, daily life. So many authors. I wrote extensively about Dostoevsky, an author that influenced me. Not that I'm a Dostoevskyan author, but who I identified with my understanding of East-West, identifying with East-West, developing a sort of love and hate relationship with East-West, so forth and so on. I put all these articles, cultural articles, political articles, prize acceptance speeches, articles on movies, architectural, arts, paintings. I wanted to be a painter between the ages of 7 and 22. I carved up to make a continuous narrative. Here is another one. Again, perhaps they were calling me, 2 hours left. I wrote very fast about my daughter being sad and how it feels to have a daughter who feels sad. Do you know what, darling? When you're this sad, I'm sad too. I feel as if there is this instinct buried somewhere deep inside me, in my body, my soul, well, somewhere. When I see you sad, I get sad. It is as if some computer inside me says, when you see that Ria is sad, you get sad too. I can get sad for no reason too, and just as suddenly, I can be in the middle of an ordinary day, tending to the refrigerator, or the paper, or my mind, or my hair. My mind goes off on a tangent, this life, but let's stop for a moment. I look at Ria, and her face is dark and clouded. She is curled up on the divan, just lying there. What's made her so unhappy? Watching the world from the corner of her eye and her father watching her watch the world. In one hand is a blue rabbit. On her other hand, she is resting her unhappy face. I walk back to the kitchen to rummage through the drawers of the refrigerator and my mind. What could it be, I wonder? Does she have a stomachache? Or maybe she's discovering the taste of her melancholy. Let her be. Let her be sad. Let her lose herself in solitude and her own smell. The first aim of an intelligent person is to achieve unhappiness when everyone around her is happy. So I once thought. I like it when people say Borgesian things. Indeed, I try whenever possible to be as unhappy as all young people. That's good, but beware, she's not a young person yet. She's a child. Silence. I open the refrigerator, pick up a huge, bright, red apple, and bite into it as hard as I can. I leave the kitchen. She's still lying there in a ball. I pause to think. Make an approach. Say, come, let's play dice. And where's the box? Find a box, and as you open it, ask each other, what color are you going to be? I'm green. Okay, then I'll be red. Then throw the dice, count the squares, and make sure she wins. If she starts wanting to win, if she starts enjoying herself, she'll brighten up and say, I'm winning. So take the lead then, win every game. Sometimes I get fed up. I think, let me win, even if it's just once. Let this girl learn how to lose. It doesn't work. She throws away the dice. She overturns the game board. She goes off to sulk in the corner. Why don't I suggest a game of stay off the floor? You can go from the table to the dining chairs, from the dining chairs to the armchairs, the divan, the other table, the side of the radiator. You can touch the floor, but if you get caught with your foot on the floor, you're it. But don't try to jump too far. The best game is chess. All around the house, around the table, from room to room, around the dining chairs, while the television drones on about the latest paradises, coups, rebellions, and beauty contests, and the dollar and the stock exchange. And look at us, see how we're chasing each other and paying no attention to you and all your nonsense. As we run about madly, overturning baskets, knocking over lamps, crushing castles of newspaper piles, coupons and cardboard, starting to sweat, shouting, but without knowing what exactly we're shouting about, we sometimes take off our clothes. If only you knew how fast we can run over chocolate wrappers, coloring books, broken toys, old newspapers, discarded water bottles, slippers and boxes. But I couldn't even do this. I sat in a corner and watched the color of dirt settling quietly over the roar of the city. The television was on, but there was no sound, none at all. One of those seagulls was walking slowly across the roof. I recognized it from its patter. The two of us gazed out the window without speaking for the longest time. I in my chair and Ria on the divan. And we both, Ria sadly, I with joy, thought about how beautiful it was. And I used to take her to school, and she was upset about that. I used to cut school in high school. She used to cut school in primary school. There is a continuity. Again, here's a fast monologue that I almost copied from her, whatever she said about not going to school. I'm not going to school because I'm sleepy, I'm cold, no one likes me at school. I'm not going to school because there are two children there. They are bigger than me, they are stronger than me. When I go past them, they stick out their arms and block my way. I'm afraid. I'm afraid. I'm not going to school. At school, time just stops. Everything gets left outside, outside the school door. My room at home, for example, also my mother, my father, my toys, and the birds on the balcony. When I'm at school and I think about them, I want to cry. I look out the window, in the sky outside, there are clouds. I'm not going to school because I don't like anything there. The other day, I did a picture of a tree. The teacher said, "That's really a tree. Well done." I did another one. This one had no leaves either. Then one of those children came over and made fun of me. I'm not going to school. When I go to bed at night and I think about going to school the next day, I feel terrible. I say, "I'm not going to school." They say, "How can you say that? Everyone goes to school." Everyone? So let everyone go then. What's going to happen if I stay home? I went yesterday, didn't I? How about if I don't go tomorrow and then go the day after that? If only I were at home in my bed or in my room. If only I were anywhere but that school. I'm not going to school. I'm sick. Can't you see? The moment someone says school, I feel sick. I get a stomachache. I can't even drink that milk. I'm not going to drink that milk. I'm not going to eat anything, and I'm not going to school either. I'm so upset. No one likes me. There are those two children. They stick out their arms and block my way. I went to the teacher. The teacher said, "Why are you following me? I'll tell you something if you promise not to get mad. I'm always following the teacher, and the teacher is always saying, 'Don't follow me.' I'm not going to school ever again. Why? Because I just don't want to go to school. That's why. When it's recess, I don't want to go outside either. Just when everyone's forgotten me, then it's recess. Then everything gets all mixed up. Everyone starts running." The teacher gives me a nasty look, and she doesn't look too good to start with. I don't want to go to school. There is one child who likes me. He He's the only one who looks at me nicely. Don't tell anyone, but I don't like that child either. I just sit down and stare there. I feel so lonely. Tears run down my cheeks. I don't like school at all. I don't want to go to school, I say. Then it's morning and they take me to school. I can't even smile. I look straight in front of me. I want to cry. I climb up the hill with a bag on my back that is as big as soldiers, and I keep my eyes on my little feet as they climb the hill. Everything so heavy, the bag on my back, the hot meats in my stomach, I want to cry. I walk into school, the black metal garden gate closes behind me. I cry, "Mommy, look, you left me inside." Then I go into my classroom and sit down. I want to become one of those clouds outside. Erasers, notebooks, and pens, feed them to the hens. When I wrote these articles and put them in books, first in Turkish and then later in translations, my daughter loves to have a look at these books, and I devoted two of my books to her, makes it sure that all the translations, all the editors get those devotions right. Now she's 16, but it was so much fun, especially this "I'm not going to school" article was put in anthologies, and I don't know if it was school anthologies in so many places. In this book, I also put together prize acceptance speeches that I wrote in the last 5 years, and the most, and also the Nobel Prize acceptance speech. There I try to answer, along with so many things that troubled me all my life, the question that we writers had been asked most often, and the question is, of course, why do you write? Here is a sort of a poetic statement about this, about a sort of a poetic answer to the statement. Not a very logical, but then heartfelt answer. Why do you write? I write because I have an innate need to write. I write because I can't do normal work like other people. I write because I want to read books like the ones I write. I write because I am angry at all of you, angry at everyone. I write because I love sitting in a room all day writing. I write because I can only partake in real life by changing it. I write because I want others, all of us, the whole world, to know what sort of life we lived and continue to live in Istanbul, in Turkey. I write because I love the smell of paper, pen, and ink. I write because I believe in literature, in the art of the novel, more than I believe in anything else. I write because it's a habit, a passion. I write because I'm afraid of being forgotten. I write because I like the glory and interest that writing brings. I write to be alone. Perhaps I write because I hope to understand why I am so very, very angry at all of you, so very, very angry at everyone. I write because I like to be read. I write because once I have begun a novel, an essay, a page, I want to finish it. I write because everyone expects me to write. I write because I have a childish belief in the immortality of libraries and in the way my books sit on the shelf. I write because it is exciting to turn all of life's beauties and riches into words. I write not to tell a story, but to compose a story. I write because I wish to escape from the foreboding that there is a place I must go, but just as in a dream, I can't quite get there. I write because I have never managed to be happy. I write to be happy. Here are some questions, and perhaps others will be coming. So I'll read some of them and try to understand. What do you miss most about Istanbul? Well, I don't miss it too much. It's with me all the time. I have spent 52 years, 53 years in Istanbul. I'm 55 years old. And the last 3 years, I'm traveling a lot, around the world a lot. Politically pressured there a bit. And I'm also teaching at New York, at Columbia University. But then if you spend 50 years in a town, it's with you all the time. You can't get rid of it. It's with you. You feel its presence as you feel your body, your family, your mother. Towns, cities, countries, nations are giving us to, just like as we have our families, and just as we learn how to get along with them, how to love them, we also love our cities, our places. Question: How do you feel about Doris Lessing following you as a Nobel laureate? Well, I'm pleased. I have read to. I think The Golden Notebook and The Grass Is Singing are great novels. I've read them almost 30 years ago, but the rest of her output I couldn't follow. What is the hardest thing about writing? Well, this person wanted to get to the bones of the thing. The hardest thing is about perhaps, now, there are things that are hard to me, and there are things that would be hard to the person who had never written but who wants to be a writer. Things that are hard to me are different, maybe I'll go into that, but let me try to see what my experience of the hardest thing that the would-be writers feel. It's first being sure of yourself, being convinced about what you want to do, what you want to express, being alone with a text. Writing is a solitary business, as I made clear in this book. I wrote so many articles about that a writer is a person who goes inward. A writer is a man, is a person, a man or a woman, who is troubled by something, locks himself, herself in a room, and goes inward, perhaps to discover some hidden inner wound that he or she is not thoroughly aware of. But the more he works, the more she works to discover it, the more she understands that we all have these secret wounds inside us. Writing is about acknowledging, understanding, addressing these secret wounds that, as if we go deeper and deeper, that we understand all humanity share. But in order to go that much, that further, we have to have self-confidence, self-respect, to be brave enough to continue, to trust ourselves, and to be able to continue in this way, even if the wind stops, even if nothing happens, even if everyone looks at us with irony, smiling, even making fun of us. Writing is a solitary business because you are on your own, you know, just like is in death. That's the hard part from an outsider. But then I'm used to it. I can take it. I've been living solitary hours every day, 10 hours, 8 hours for the last 34 years. It's okay. Also, I have developed a habit of reading what I write to people around me, to my loved ones, to people who I share my life with. So it's also a consolation. Thank you for coming.
That was Orhan Pamuk speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 2007. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces The Archive Project for radio and podcast. Theme music for The Archive Project is by Emancipator. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.